Welcome to the 13th episode of Steel Watching, which is a podcast for Remington Steel fans. My name is Sarah, and I'm one of the hosts.
And I am Eric, and I am your other host.
And we're going to be talking about the episode, A Good Night's Steel. This episode first aired on January 21st, 1983, and it was written by R.J. Stewart and Lee Zlotoff, and directed by Seymour Robbie. So for this one,
as long as not Seymour Butts.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I didn't want to say it. Way to go.
I'm sorry. I just...
Is there a Seymour Butts? Hey, I want to see more butts. Sorry, Seymour Robbie.
Sorry, Robbie. Yep. Anyway,
for this one, I decided to go with the TV guide listing from Judith's book, and it's pretty short and to the point. It just says, Laura and Steele go undercover as a doctor and patient at a sleep disorder clinic that's missing morphine and a physician. So that was pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
So you'll have to forgive me for my voice. I should probably say this as well. I caught a cold 3 weeks ago now, and my voice left me, and it's returning, but slowly. So I still kind of sound a little bit rough. But starting off the episode, I mentioned who wrote it. And I kind of want to talk about how TV shows were written around this time versus how they're written now. And this is my ADHD brain at work, because I saw the name Lee Zlotoff appear. We've seen his name appear before so far. And back in the 80s, it was less common to have a writing staff for the show. There might be one or two regular writers, but most of the time they were taking scripts, either spec scripts or just hiring people to do one-off episodes here and there, which allowed for a lot of single episode writers. And I mean, this kind of fits with the older format of television, which was less continuous because it made more sense to be. Ratings-wise, it was a lot harder to keep up with every single episode, and not everybody had VCRs in their house, or presetting your VCR was not as common. So if you tried to get a show like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones off the ground, where every episode led into the next, your ratings would tank, because if you miss one episode, you fall behind. So shows like that today have a tighter staff of writers because they're less episodic. They have to keep up with continuity in a way that previous shows didn't have to. So all this to say, I'm paying attention to who I see writing-wise pop up repeatedly, and so far the name Lee Zlotoff has come up a few times. So I'm going to try to make an effort to look for the writers that show up over and over, because I know that one of my other favorite shows, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I became a fan of specific writers, and if they had a specific writer that was writing an episode, I knew I would either like it or dislike it, depending on the writer. So I wondered if you had noticed that for any of the writers so far, or have been paying attention or do pay attention with other TV shows?
Not really. Not generally. There might be an instance where I might do that at some point, but usually it's in retrospect because, for example, Janet Tomorrow was the creator and showrunner for Rizzoli and Isles.
Oh, I like that show.
And after I had started watching that show and I had watch some of the, you know, the DVD extras, the stuff that you don't get when you stream shows from your favorite streaming service, you know, the extras. Yep. That's why I love DVDs.
Oh, me too.
And so I was watching the DVDs and her name kept coming up, of course, because she was the showrunner and she was the creator of the show. And as I was going through and watching Bones again, I kept seeing her name. And so it's like, I start seeing, like I said, in retrospect, I start seeing connections. So that's how I have been noticing those things. But generally, in advance, it's not like you're talking about where I say, oh, I like this writer, so I'll watch this. Oh, I don't like this writer, so I probably skip this episode, that sort of thing. I don't think I've ever done that. I don't imagine I ever will in that respect.
I mean, like I said, I've done it for specific shows that are genre-based, because you typically see a lot of the same writers write for different shows. And if you know the writer, you kind of, again, have an idea of what you're going to get. Remington Steele wasn't really that kind of show. So I haven't really been paying attention. But given that when we've started doing the beginnings of this, mentioning who directed it, who wrote it. Wow.
Who wrote it?
Teach English.
You as an English teacher.
To read makes our speaking English good. Who wrote it? I start to know, like, I've seen Lee Zlotoff's name pop up over and over. Mm-hmm. Who knows whether or not I will start to notice any consistencies with his writing or hers. I don't know if Lee is a woman or a man. I'm assuming a man because the show had very few female.
So sexist of you. So sexist.
There was only like three women, I think, that wrote for the show or something like that. So I don't know, but it just like a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as I mentioned before, had a very specific writing staff, and those writers had branched off and written for different things. And when you watch something like Gilmore Girls and you see that Jane Espenson wrote for Gilmore Girls as well as Buffy, and then you start to see the patterns with the type of episodes, the type of humor, and that sort of thing. I've also noticed, and again, this is Buffy specific, but anytime an episode was written by somebody other than Joss Whedon, who was the show creator, every now and then you'd see something in the episode that was clearly written by Joss, because he would look at every script and punch up certain points and certain lines and things like that. So even if it wasn't a Joss written episode, you could see the Joss isms pop up, and you can almost pick it out and go, oh yeah, that was a punch up. And it started to bleed into other things that I've seen. Love him or hate him, he was an uncredited scriptwriter for he used to script doctor films. So at any time you'd have a movie where the script maybe wasn't great or they needed to fix, they'd hire him and he would fix it, or he would add scenes or whatever. And he script doctored the movie Speed with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock. And whenever I rewatch it now, I can find the lines. Even though he was uncredited for it, I can find the things that I just know he wrote. And I'm like, that's the Joss line. So I'm paying attention. I'm looking at the names that pop up, and we'll see whether or not any patterns show up. But I just kind of thought that was a cool thing to open with, because I've never paid attention with this show for writers. So
you're making me look bad.
And that was the goal. No, I'm kidding.
So
the actual episode. For the scene opener, we get the sleep clinic. The first shot is the stats monitor. It's unplugged. Another plug's plugged into it. Obviously another machine. Then we pan over to a different room, and a woman is on the phone flirting with whoever she's talking to. She's fingering a blood bag, which is weird. I have a couple questions.
I've got several questions. Yeah,
I bet you do. Yeah, I'm assuming that maybe they're the same questions. So let me know if they are. Because my first one was, can blood just be left sitting out like that? Doesn't it have to be stored a certain way? And is this like,
I think so, yeah,
ethical? Like going back to our ethics question mark? Like, who would do that? Help.
Well, I do think you are correct that blood does have to be kept at certain temperatures.
Yeah. Room
temperature not being that temperature. But yeah, you know, my question as I had it written down is, are hospitals really a hotbed of secret sexual rendezvous? Oh, I mean, I can't imagine. I guess in some ways I can, because you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to do it wherever you're at. But
true,
it just seems like, no, that's so wrong. That's just so wrong.
I'm not really a fan of hospital dramas personally. They're not my thing, but I do know, I've never watched either show, but ER and Grey's Anatomy.
Okay.
From what I'm told from friends of mine who do watch it, that there's like tons of sexual rendezvous in the hospital. So I mean, I watched House. That's probably the closest I got. And I don't recall any big sexual rendezvous in the hospital in that one. So
Let's see. You could have the broom closet. Let's see. You could have a patient room that you somehow secure the door to, because usually they don't lock. Boy, there's a lot of risky places to do something. I can't think of too many secure, safe places to do something like that.
The morgue, everybody's dead.
Yeah, well, that's just plain weird.
It is. The whole thing is weird. She's fingering a blood bag. It's weird. Mm-hmm.
And the first part of that opening, wouldn't it be risky to switch somebody's controls? I mean, somebody should be monitoring. Now, whether they actually were or not, maybe they're out having themselves a little sexual rendezvous somewhere, but somebody should be watching, and you would think they would notice.
They mention later on that's the nurse's job. She takes like a half hour break to make her rounds. That crazy nurse that was like...
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But did he... Well, I guess he would have known it, but maybe he wouldn't have. I don't know. But just in general, it just seemed like it was kind of a risky... Two really risky things to do.
And we're only like 30 seconds in.
Yes.
So yeah, it's only going to get better, folks. this is not a hospital. I'm wondering what the insurance is like on this hospital, because there's other things that I'm sure we're going to get into that had me thinking, I don't know that I'd want to be a patient there personally.
No.
So yeah, there's that. And then, as you mentioned, she agrees to meet her mysterious boyfriend and is strangled to death. And as she's being killed, she squeezes the blood bag open and it spills all over the place. So, but this was interesting to me for one reason. And that is, you know, that whole going back to the blood isn't real on Remington Steele. And okay, the blood in the blood pack does look kind of fake.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, they're right. But on the other hand, this is the first time I think we've seen a lot of blood. And what do you think about this after the show has been so bloodless for the past 12 episodes? We've had people shot. We've had people collapse dead in someone's arms after being shot, not seen a single drop. So, you know, what do you think about this particular scene with like all of the blood just spurting out?
Well, like you said, the blood clearly looks kind of not real.
No.
So, you know, I think, when I very, very first time I saw this, I probably wasn't sure what it was supposed to be because of that.
That's true.
So I don't know if I can give you an answer to that question. I really don't think about it now. I mean, even now it just looks like Kool-Aid. Yeah, so yeah, I don't really give it a lot of thought, but yes, you're right. It's first time we've ever seen this much blood, put that in sarcasm quotes.
Yeah.
On the show, probably the last time we see so much blood, but it is a little unusual for the show. That is true.
I don't think it happens again. You're right. And it sort of makes me think of MASH in a sense that the first few seasons of MASH, they were essentially told they couldn't show any blood, even though they were a mobile army surgical hospital and they're operating on people and you would see blood. And then as the show went on, the network, I guess, became less stringent about that because you would see them operating on people and their aprons would be stained with blood.
Or you would see them operating on somebody and suddenly you'd see blood spurting out of the body.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of wonder if this was their way of testing the waters with this, just to see if there was any audience reaction to it or if people or the network responded a specific way, but they didn't really do their best trying to make it look real. I mean, I've watched a lot of horror movies and that, you're right, it looked like Kool-Aid. So you need
corn syrup. Kool-Aid isn't real on Remington Steele.
Don't drink it. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Anyway,
yes.
We switch to Steele making dinner. And it's obvious he knows what he's doing because, you know, the whole setup just looks like he has done this many, many times before. The dish looks really good.
Except it's a gas stove.
Yeah.
And there are no burners visibly lit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm assuming that was a set thing. They probably couldn't, but yeah.
Well, there's ways of faking it. I mean, after all, look at what they can do at Disneyland with pieces of fabric and colored lights.
That's true. Or they could have just made it an electric stove. That would have made a lot more sense.
Not if he's a gourmet chef.
True. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, okay. I'll grant that it was probably just slipped through. But, yeah, like I said, Disney can do a lot of things with shreds of fabric and colored lights that make it look pretty convincing.
Fair enough. What's interesting to me about this is that for all the effort that the show went to challenge the gender stereotypes when it came to women, Laura being independent, a person who's not really obsessed with finding a husband, settling down as a housewife, etc. The show was kind of doing the same for men in some ways. We've got a romantic lead in Steele who is not your typical macho action hero of the 80s. He can throw a fist if he needs to, but he isn't masculine in the stereotypical way it's defined. There are some other traits that he has that are often ascribed to women, like his talent in the kitchen, his penchant for, you know, the finer things in life, the way he sort of carries himself. What do you think about this? Why do you think they chose to shy away from the standard action hero portrayal and give him some, for lack of a better word, more feminine traits?
Well, I know that in interviews, including on the DVD commentaries and some of the special features, Michael Gleason said that his goal was to take the detective genre and turn it upside down. And in fact, in the, what was the name of the episode? The one with the bums on the skid row and the alarms.
Tempered Steel.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He deliberately wrote the scene where he rescues Laura, not by being the hero and coming in, but because he's looking for something to write with. He's looking for a pencil. He's looking for Ben. You know, the same problem he has on his desk. He can't find his pencils.
That man's got to get to a stationery store.
Yeah, you know, you can have that stuff delivered.
Yeah.
So Gleason's whole concept for the show was to take the detective genre and turn it upside down. And basically, I don't think he said this, but basically take the traits of the male and female detectives and flip them around. So yeah. All the thing that you would typically ascribe to with a male detective in terms of their approach,
right,
the way they operate was transferred to Laura. And then the girl Friday was transferred to Steele. So it makes sense that he would do something like he cooks in the kitchen. He's a gourmet cook. Yeah. Makes sense.
And she can't cook to save her life, as we find out later on.
Nor can she drive.
Yeah. I mean, she can safely is the, you know, where we get into the gray area, but she.
I'm surprised she still has any insurance on her vehicle.
Right.
I could just imagine being the insurance agent. No, I'm sorry. After 47 accidents in 3 years, we can't. No, we're going to have to cancel your policy because you're too high risk.
Yeah. What is it you do?
Besides wreck cars.
Yeah. But I mean, I love how this begins with him in the kitchen cooking a meal. It shows how far their relationship has progressed without even realizing it. He's stressed about her showing up. Like, he's actually kind of really sort of wanting this to go well. And from the earliest episodes, we've seen him ask her out last minute because one of his dates cancels on him. And now he's spending hours preparing a meal for her, which is a clear indicator that she's not like the other women he's seen. I can't see him doing this for Nadine or Miss Taplinger or whoever else he might be seeing at the time. I'm wondering if you think he's still seeing other women now the way he was at the beginning. Is he going through his little back book? Is he sort of subconsciously not doing that as much? What do we think?
I'm going to say he's probably not doing it as much. He's probably still doing it.
Yeah. But
yeah, he definitely would not do anything. Even for Felicia, I don't think he would do something like this.
No, I can't see that.
So he's definitely making an effort, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's not seeing other women while he's making that effort. You know, eggs in one basket.
Oh, for sure. Thing. Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. I think he might have slowed down again subconsciously, not really intentionally. I don't think there was ever a point as of yet where he said, well, I'm not going to see other women. I'm just going to pursue Laura. But I also think maybe he hasn't made a date in a while because he just kind of seems to be more invested in the agency and his situation that is currently taking place. So.
And yeah. I think if he's making dates with other women, they're probably more casual than they had been previously. It's just, oh, here's this event. You might enjoy it. I might enjoy it. So let's just go out, have a good time together this evening doing this or that. But he's not looking at that as being a stepping stone to something else. He's just looking at it as, okay, we're going out on a date. That's it.
Yeah.
Nothing more.
And in a way, that's less effort. It's easy to buy tickets to the ballet or to wherever it is you're going. It's easier to go out for a nice dinner at a restaurant where you're not the one cooking. Give her a nameplate that the restaurant has miraculously made for you, which have not reappeared at all since.
Of course, I've never been back to that restaurant that we've seen.
No, not that we've seen. But this is more domestic. It's arguably more thoughtful, and it's, I think, definitely more intimate. And we can see this in the fact that he's wearing jeans. That sounds weird, but he hasn't, unless they're going on a case where they're somewhere where a suit might not be appropriate or might get dirty, you know, when we see it later when they go in, I think, steals gold and stuff like that. He doesn't typically wear jeans. He wears his suits, his fine tailored suits. Mm-hmm. But here he's wearing a pair of jeans. He's in his house. He's comfortable. This is his space. And I think that is interesting as well.
Yeah. It's definitely not. Obviously, Laura wasn't really expecting it. And it's definitely not expected, I think, for the audience as well. Because
he should have told her, you know, he should have said, I'm making dinner, not come for dinner.
Yeah, but, you know, he does say he wanted to surprise her and impress her. And the surprise would make the being impressed bigger, more of a thing. Yeah. So he was trying to impress her. This is more than just casual.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of taking it to that figurative next level. You know, what is it with women in the next level? But yeah, he's taking it to the, trying to take
we're
it
like
to the next level.
Like a multi-level marketing scam. You have to get to the next level. Yeah.
But sorry. Yeah, I mean, making an effort to do something like that, that's unexpected, surprising, and going to be appreciated.
For
because
sure.
Because of that. That says something. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, she shows up, he apologizes to her preemptively for any faux pas he may have committed, which is funny.
That reminds me of a Home Improvement episode.
Oh, which one?
It was called Luck Be a Tailor Tonight.
Okay.
Tim had some guys over to play poker. And one of the guys that was over there was the husband of one of Jill's sisters. And they'd had an argument coming over. And the men are trying to explain to this guy how to handle the situation. And
I can see where this is going to go. Yeah. I'm vaguely remembering it. So, yeah.
And so the thing that Tim says as the way to handle it is every day I get up in the morning, I look her in the eyes and say, Jill, I'm sorry. And they say, for what? Everything. Just being a man, having an Adam's apple, just breathing. That's it. And that's what Steele's doing here is he's just, I don't know what I did wrong. Whatever it is, I apologize. You know, obviously it's my fault. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a good point. And I think it's because he's afraid that she's going to call off dinner. He's trying to like, whatever I did, whatever I said, I'm sorry. Just don't cancel. And of course,
she does worse than cancel.
Yeah. Well, yeah. she brings a clock. I'll get there. But she jokes that, or she points out his aftershave is burning. And this is where she sees that he cooks, right? And he says something along the lines of, you know, dinner was meant to weaken her defenses, which is also interesting because he hasn't blatantly flirted like this in a while. She says, I don't know what to say. And then he says, say yes and let me make up the question, which is probably one of, I think, my favorite line of the episode because it's very obvious innuendo there. And this is where you pointed out her being very surprised by his efforts and seeming genuinely regretful about having to cancel because they have a case. And it's also interesting that she comes over to involve him right away. Murphy is nowhere to be seen. In fact, he's not in this episode.
True.
And they behave effortlessly as partners throughout the entire episode.
Well, I think you have to qualify that word partners because
fair.
What is it she does? She volunteers him and sets him up to be a target. I mean, that's not a very partnery thing to do.
It's also kind of, I guess volunteer is the wrong word, voluntel.
Voluntel. Well, it's the government version of volunteer.
Yeah.
You will do it or else.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. You're right. It is rather, she does kind of set him up as bait.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly what he is.
Okay. Okay, maybe rethinking that there for a second. recalibrating. Okay. So yeah, he's obviously not happy about this turn of events.
First you deflate my duck and now you want to cook my goose.
Speaking of, have you ever had canard au vin rouge?
No, and I was trying to figure out what that was because I can find a canard au vin translated, but all the listings for canard au vin rouge are in French and I don't speak French.
Okay, so this is where my Canadianness helps.
Canadianness? And it sounds like a disease.
Yeah, it is. I'm afflicted. I can't help it. Every 2 weeks I have to get my double-double from Tim Hortons or something goes really bad. But if you know, you know. But we have to learn French from, it's part of the curriculum because it is our second official language. So we learn it in some cases from grade 1 all the way through to grade 9, or depending on your board, sometimes it doesn't start till grade 4, but either way, it's a necessary part of our curriculum. So it translates, it's duck and red wine sauce. The rouge is French for red, vin is wine. So duck in red wine, and I've never had this specifically, but I looked up a recipe for it just because I was curious. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because they kind of, I mean, the recipe I found is probably obviously not the same thing that he's using, but it does kind of track with the setup in his kitchen, because this recipe, you have the duck that you sear over medium high heat, then you brown it, then you set it aside in the same skillet. You're browning shallots and garlic, deglazing with the wine, bringing it to a boil, simmering it for 4 to 5 minutes, put the duck back in the skillet. And we do see things bubbling and boiling, and he's got spices and things that he's cooking. So I'm assuming it's roughly a similar type of recipe, which I thought was kind of cool and made me want to make it. So if I do, well, I'll let you know how it turns out.
Yeah. I would assume that they had somebody on set who was at least, well, they had to have somebody on set to do the food preparation.
Yep.
So I'm going to guess that they, well, if we're going to show it as this, let's just make this. And maybe. Here's all the stuff I needed to make it. So there you go. There's your set dressing.
That'd be a fun day at craft services. Mm-hmm. Hey guys, we just finished the scene. There's a canard au vin rouge over by the table there.
Yeah. Of course, it's been sitting under the lights for 8 hours.
It might not be.
Not so been. Fresh. Yeah.
But anyway, she shows up with this client, Mr. Lindstrom, and I have to wonder, I don't think we've ever seen her bring a client to their home or to his home or to her home. Why wouldn't she just call him and ask him to meet her at the office? I realize he said that he doesn't want to go to the office in case his colleagues got wind of the fact that he went to a private detective, but how? Are people following him? Are they spying on him? I mean,
well, I wouldn't think so. That really doesn't quite track.
No.
Unless, as you say, he was afraid that somebody was investigating his clinic, and if they saw him going to a detective's office, they would say, uh-huh, there's something going on.
Yeah. Well, and not even that, because those buildings have tons of other offices in them.
That's true.
You'd have to follow him up to the door. He could be seeing, what is it, the Cohen and Carstairs? He could be from, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
Yeah. And there's a jewelry store up above them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's below them.
It's below them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, it could have been a lot of places he was going. So, it's just paranoia, overactive sense of paranoia.
Or plot necessity. Yeah, paranoia. I mean, that fits. He tells them that that morphine has gone missing and one of their doctors and her car hasn't left the parking lot. I have to wonder, she'd be reported missing by someone, right? I mean, Lindstrom himself should theoretically have a duty to report it. But even if he didn't, I'm assuming she'd have friends or family in her life that would wonder why she hasn't been seen. It just seems odd that nobody has noticed that this woman's gone missing.
Well, it may have something to do with her profession as a doctor, depending on what her past schedule has been, what her current schedule is. I suppose it's possible that her being gone, if we can call it that, being out of communication for an extended period of time is not necessarily unusual.
Yeah, you're right. You could be right. Especially without cell phones and immediate ways of contacting people. Mm-hmm. If you don't reach somebody on the phone, you'd leave a message on their machine and they would get back to you whenever they got back to you. That's how we did it in the old days. So,
yeah. Or if you were calling their office and they weren't in, you would leave a message with somebody and they may or may not get the message. Or if they did get the message, they may or may not respond immediately or soon, depending on what they're going on. And I can imagine that now, this is a sleep clinic. It's not really a hospital in the same sense that most people think of it. So there's not an ER. But I would imagine that there are situations and times that they are out of contact for an extended period of time because they're dealing with things.
I thought it was a hospital because they mentioned later on that it's a teaching hospital. So my assumption was that the sleep clinic was part of the overall, like we have a teaching hospital just down the road from us. It's connected to the university. And so you've got an ER, you've got various different departments, but you've also got specific areas that are meant for instruction in whatever particular part of medicine that you're trying to teach. So I got the impression that there were parts of the hospital that were hospital, but this particular area is a clinic. It's not really connected because they do have a morgue.
It is. Yeah, it's a little bit contradictory or confusing, at least to me, because my impression was that this was a clinic that was kind of run and owned by Lindstrom, that it was a private clinic. But no, you're right. They do have a morgue, and hospitals do have set up specialty clinics within themselves. So yeah, you could very well be right. I could have just simply misinterpreted the information that was being presented.
Which brings me to my next question. I didn't think about her suggesting Steele be bait. What to me was deeply irresponsible was the concept of her going undercover as a physician.
Well, that's another issue too. Yeah. Because she obviously doesn't know anything about medicine.
She really doesn't. She doesn't even know where the heart is.
That's basic. I mean, that's basic health class stuff, you know? Yeah.
It just seems like a bad idea all around. Now, granted,
yes,
she's not being asked to perform heart surgery, but still, if these people are ongoing patients that are having their sleep issues treated and diagnosed and a plan is being made up, et cetera, bringing somebody in that is not a physician, that is not familiar with their case and wouldn't know what to do even if they were, all for the sake of finding another doctor who's gone missing, is putting other patients at risk. I would think that Lindstrom would be opening himself up for a huge lawsuit if something went wrong. So,
well, I think it also changed a little bit because initially, in the meeting at Steele's apartment, Laura was going to be introduced as Steele's doctor.
Yeah.
But then after we get to the clinic, it's revealed that she is taking over the cases for the other doctor.
Dr. Marcus.
So that's a different thing entirely than what was discussed earlier on. So at what point did that change and who changed
good
it
question.
And why? Was that just Lindstrom shooting off his mouth and, oh, let me paint myself and everybody else into a corner, and so now you have to cover for us?
You're right, because I didn't even think of that either, because it would have made perfect sense for her to go in and just be his quote doctor, because then she's not hurting anybody. But you're right, the minute she gets there, she's literally given all these case files, and it's like, that's not good.
Quickly. And it's so terribly obvious that she knows nothing about what she's supposed to know something about.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. It's painfully obvious. And the reasoning behind it is that they'd recognize Steele. If he pretended to be a doctor, they'd recognize him, but they wouldn't recognize her. At the same time, she's really bad at it. She's just not good at undercover, at least.
Yes. They may not recognize that she's not a doctor just from knowing who she was, but they would certainly recognize that she's not a doctor simply because she doesn't know what she's doing.
No, not even a little bit. So, and this is where we get the line that you like, because Steele is really upset about having to pose as an insomniac. And she points out, as I said, that he would immediately be a target. So she's, yeah, you're going to be bait. Here you go. Go be bait. Yes. And then that's where he says the hoisted by my own canard, which is one I really like, yes. As well as first you deflate my duck and now you want to cook my goose. So those are some really good. If we're looking at writers, Lise Lotoff, I like the cut of your jib. I've never said that before. I never will again. I apologize. But yeah. So then we switch to the clinic and Steele is getting an examination by a really scary looking nurse. She has no bedside manner and describes him as being as healthy as a prize pig. And we switch over to Laura being given her tour of the hospital by the administrator, who clearly doesn't know that she's not a doctor, and tells her that she is going to have access to Dr. Marcus's files. Now, we've already talked about how this is dangerous, but isn't it also an ethical breach to have her on Lindstrom's part? Because obviously the administrator doesn't know that she's not a doctor, but wouldn't it be really unethical for her to be looking at private medical files of these patients?
Yes, I would think so. Here in the United States, we have something called the HIPAA, which is a Privacy Act. Right. I don't know if that was in place at the time that this show aired, but even if it wasn't, yeah, I mean, that would be kind of unethical.
Yeah. Like, there's so much ethics question mark in this episode that it just kind of boggled my mind that it made it past the, I don't know, I guess for plot reasons, this is what they have to do, but Laura is not a, she's not good at undercover. Her not so subtle attempt at asking the nurse what her theory is on Dr. Marcus's disappearance. Like, she doesn't bite. She takes Steele away to his room. And then the other doctor, Terry Wickers, he overhears and asks if the patient is the Remington Steele. And that's when he says, "Welcome to the Big Sleep," which is a movie reference. And then when he asks her where she studied, she sticks to the truth and says Stanford. And then he asks her if she studied with Dr. Laker and she says, "Wonderful man," which obviously is not the case. And this is interesting too, because with Laura's initial assumption that Laker is a man, it kind of shows that she falls prey to the same bias that everybody else does, because Steele made that, I mean, he knew that Laura wasn't a secretary, or at least suspected, but it kind of shows that she's not immune to this assumption of certain professions being male professions versus female professions.
Well, I think she falls victim to that stereotype, possibly because even at this time, it was still not as many women in the profession. And certainly not as doctors. Nurses, yes, but not necessarily doctors, and certainly not instructors.
Yeah, okay, fair. I mean, although it is interesting because she's replacing a female doctor that has gone missing. But I guess you're right, she's the only one there. The others are all men, so. Mm-hmm.
I do like her line when she tries to cover for herself, though. Wicker says, he's a plumber, and she says, well, you know, internal medicine wasn't one of my favorites, but.
The man did earn his degree.
Yeah. Calling a guy who specializes in internal medicine a plumber. That's got to be, I can't imagine how a real doctor specializing in internal medicine would react to being called a plumber.
It's the whole thing is funny because, again, she's really bad at undercover. In this whole episode, it's just one misstep after another, and that's a good one, so we've got then Steele is being led down a corridor by this militant nurse. I wonder if it's, again, another sort of nurse ratchet situation.
I think so. That's what I had written down. Yeah.
Yeah. His earlier line of, even if she is innocent, I think we should give serious consideration to framing her is pretty funny. Yeah. So it's kind of good. And then he gets shown to his room. Paul Reiser pops his head out as Steele walks down the room. Paul Reiser, I'm sure if people ever saw the show Mad About You would recognize Paul Reiser, a bit younger, obviously, but he plays the narcoleptic. And then he meets this very abrasive man called Bickerman, who claims not to have slept in months. And I'm assuming he's being euphemistic, because you'd have to have slept at least a little bit. It's not possible to go that long without sleep. And I can say personally from experience, because 3 years ago, almost in 2019, I injured my back, and I injured my back in such a way that I don't even know how it happened. This is, I guess, what happens when you get old, but like, there wasn't a specific thing that
talk.
Hey, you know what?
You're not old.
I'm old enough. Cause like it crippled me almost. It was devastating. For the first week, I couldn't lay down at all. I couldn't sit down at all. And for the first 3 days of the injury, I paced morning and night. I didn't sleep. I went a full 48 hours without sleep because I literally could not sit down. I could not lay down. I couldn't do anything. I learned later that a chunk of my disc had broken off and was sitting directly on my sciatic nerve. And it was the most, I've given birth and I've never, that pain was nothing compared to this back pain. And I went into the ER and they basically did nothing. They said, oh, well, you know, if you haven't lost your bowels, you're fine. Go home. Here's some painkillers. See you later. And I went home and it was like, okay, haven't slept in 2 days. Thanks for nothing. But having not slept in 2 days, and I mean no wink of sleep, I did not nod off, I did nothing. I was on the verge of hallucinating. I was not well. You could not go any longer than that without serious psychological damage or just your body giving out and going, yeah, no, we're sleeping. So,
well, I think he was being hyperbolic.
Yeah.
You're correct. You cannot go that long without sleep. But a lot of times it feels like you've gone without sleep.
Yeah.
I know there's times that I'll come awake at night and I'll be laying there and I can trace where, okay, I must have dozed from this point to this point because there was a huge jump in time from, you know, when I looked at the clock this time to when I looked at the clock that time, but I have no recollection of having dozed.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think he's exaggerating greatly, but I can certainly sympathize with the feeling.
Oh yeah, me too. I mean, it sucks not being able to sleep. And you're right. He's probably dozed off here and there, but he's not getting that REM sleep that you need to, you know, to keep yourself healthy. And we know, of course, later on we find out he's the killer, but he seems very convinced that sleeping is lazy and kills your work ethic. And, you know, Steele is being sort of driven slowly crazy by him as he talks and talks. But I think it's really interesting. I want to set him up in contrast to, oh, his name's escaping me, for the narcoleptic. My brain's gone blank for a minute there. But the two of them are both sort of rendered victims of this mindset of work ethic being the be all and end all of productivity. Because this guy, Bickerman, is so hell-bent on getting that cushy chair that he's literally killing for it, and he's taking morphine from an injury. So I mean, there's some sympathy here on that sense, because I know what that's like. But his whole life revolves around, I have to be productive. I have to be productive. I have to get my promotion. Sleeping is lazy. Rest is lazy. I can't do any of that. And then, of course, you've got the narcoleptic on the other side of the coin who can't stop himself from sleeping, and it's affecting his everyday life because he can't hold down a job or participate meaningfully in his life. And I don't know that the show was trying to make any sort of social commentary on capitalism or things like that, but I just think it's interesting because it was such a thing, I guess, even now, like not just the 80s, but even now, like to get somewhere in your life, to go forward in your career, to move. Resting is not an option. So I don't know if you thought about that. You
sleep when you're dead.
Yeah. As Bon Jovi once said.
Yeah. No. And I think things like multitasking came out of that whole philosophy. Multitasking, contrary to what anybody believes, is not efficient.
No.
But a lot of people have been convinced that it's efficient. Yeah. And first of all, multitasking doesn't really exist. What you're doing is basically mimicking the behavior of somebody with ADHD.
Me. I have ADHD.
You're not focusing on anything for one. You're not focusing on anything for any length of time. You're constantly jumping from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing to thing. And as you jump from thing one to thing two, you have to remember, okay, where was I at at thing two? Okay, so right there, lost productivity. You're having to retrace your steps to find out and remember where you were when you left it. Lost productivity. So but it's all tied together.
Yeah. And I think it's really cleverly tied together because they've got these two opposites, right?
Yes.
And then for the bulk of the episode, he's convinced he's the killer, the narcoleptic, right?
Ivan,
because can't remember. Ivan, yes. Ivan the Terrible. I just thought that was kind of interesting. But then we've got Steele. He's wandering down the hall. He finds his way into the morgue where the bodies are sort of stacked upright, which was interesting. And we find out that later that's because it's a teaching hospital. Did he know Laura was going to be there? I don't think he did, because he almost punches her. But then why is she hanging out in the morgue? I guess maybe she's looking for Sheila Marcus? Or they didn't really explain how they both end up there.
Well, I think they were trying to coordinate a search.
Right. Okay.
And they may have made some plans to meet up at some point during that search. But I think they both independently came up with the idea of the morgue, because that's exactly why Steele would have been surprised by her and started to try and punch her. But I think that they were both kind of looking at, okay, let's see if we can do a search. Because if we assume that Sheila Marcus has been kidnapped or murdered, and if we assume that her body hadn't left the hospital, it's got to be here somewhere. We got to look for it and find it. That's the first step in, first of all, showing that it's a murder. And then second of all, it's the first step in identifying the murderer. So I think it was just a happy accident, unhappy accident, weird accident.
Well, I don't know if it's all that happy for poor Sheila Marcus, but
no.
Yeah, she's already dead. So
yeah,
it doesn't really matter. But Laura doesn't want to call the Lindstrom or the police just yet. Mm-hmm. Which, again, I kind of scratch my head at ethics? A little bit. Yeah, ethics, question mark. I mean, you've got literally a dead body. And if these are the cadavers that students are working on, what happens if they just pick her? Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah. Oh, well, we had a body, but it seems to have been...
We don't know where this one came from. So yeah, there's that. Then they go into an office. Steele wants to tell Lindstrom and lectures her on ethics, which is funny. Laura argues that if they tell Lindstrom, he will have to report it and they will get shut down. I mean, he kind of should report it, but okay. Mm-hmm. And then before they can say any more, Steele hears something. They open the door only to find Ivan, who says he knows why they are there. He's the guy who did it, and then promptly falls asleep. He's great. I don't know if you really enjoyed him, but I think he's probably one of our better guest stars as a character.
Yeah, no, I loved him. He did a great job with this role. And he plays the confused.
He really does.
Totally willing to believe anything about himself type person. Yeah, he just does it so well.
And I think it's interesting because when he says his name, and it's funny that I couldn't remember it because I can remember it now. Ivan, it's in my notes because that's how I remember it. But Ivan Terrible, or he calls himself Ivan the Terrible. And this is interesting because Ivan's name reflects how he sees himself. He sees himself as kind of terrible because he's sort of, his narcolepsy is ruining everything in his life. It ruins relationships, it ruins friendships, etc. And then you've got Bickerman, who is one of the most abrasive and argumentative people in the episode. He is literally a man who loves to bicker.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And he's given that name. So I don't know if that was intentional.
I'm sure it probably was, although there'll probably be people out there like me who just totally right over the top of the head.
Well, I did say righted earlier, so, you know.
Well, and, you know, this scene does, again, highlight Laura's absolute inability to work undercover, particularly in something as specialized as pretending to be a doctor, because all she does is repeat what Ivan says. She changes the words a little bit, but it's like, oh, yes, 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 indeed. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's just, it's terrible.
It is really, it's really bad. And he's convinced that he's killed Dr. Marcus. He's got her jacket.
Well, also because of the things that's happened to him in the past.
Yes. Yeah. And that tracks out. Because if you had done those things in your past and you wake up with this bloody jacket, you're going to assume, mm-hmm. and she's disappeared, you're going to mm-hmm. assume A plus B equals C for sure.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, as you mentioned, he talks about his condition and she just kind of like nods and echoes it back. But I did some research because I was curious to see whether or not they actually portray narcolepsy properly or if they kind of take some liberties. And very little, most of it checks out from what I was reading, all the way up to being overexcited as a trigger for falling asleep is true. Like everything that she's told by some of the other doctors, or you find out as the episode goes on, it's all kind of rooted. It's interesting. They must have done their homework on that one. So
the night terrors are also part of that.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. All of it. I mean, a patient might not have all of those things at once, but they might also,
unless they're like a really special patient.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't have narcolepsy, but I get migraines, and I am one of the fun, what we call migraineurs, who get every type of migraine. I get the tension headaches, the ice pick headaches, the every type of migraine known to man I am lucky enough to get. And I say that with sarcasm, obviously, but not a lot of people, if they suffer from migraines, they usually suffer from one particular type of migraine. They don't usually get all of them. I do. So yay. So he's Ivan's probably similar to me in that he's really profoundly unlucky. Yeah.
Well, I love the story he tells about when he was in college, his roommate finding him in his underwear, trying to drag the dean's car into the quadrangle fountain. Poisonous meteorite. The dean was still in the car.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's cute. They've got a lot of really funny little bits in this episode that I really enjoyed.
Yes.
And they leave the room. Steele is pretty happy to close this case. Over and out. It's all done. But Laura points out that there's blood on the jacket and no blood was found on Dr. Marcus, which I wonder how, because she squeezed that blood bag pretty hard. I would assume it got on more than her jacket, but okay. And Steele says he's going to get the blood checked out discreetly, but warns Laura not to turn her back on Ivan when he's asleep and references the film Coma, which I have not seen.
I have not either. I do like his line, though. He seems to do his best work on authority figures.
Yeah. Which is also, yeah, it's funny.
As far as the blood on Dr. Marcus, it's hard to tell, but the impression I got from the brief shot that we saw of her when they uncovered her on the bed is that she may have been undressed.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
After all, if you're going to hide a body in a cadaver storage room in a teaching hospital, I would presume that you would take the clothes off so that it didn't stand out as kind of being an oddball.
True. I would think it would have gotten on her face or her hands at least, because she squeezed it. So
mm-hmm. That's true.
But then maybe they didn't look at it all that, I don't know,
carefully. Yeah, they only opened it enough to see her face. So
true. Yeah.
Or at least that we saw.
Yeah. And so then we've got a switch over to Laura questioning Dr. Lindstrom on narcolepsy, which he says it's a new field when referencing autonomic behavior. And this is also true. I looked into this as well. Although narcolepsy was known about since the 19th century, it wasn't really thoroughly researched until the 70s. So this would have seemed new at the time. And I guess in this one particular instance, Laura can kind of get away with a bit of ignorance, maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
but not so much the rest of it.
Well, I guess in the sense that they're not really talking to anybody else in this conversation. It's just a conversation True. Between the two of them. You're correct. However, I would think that anybody walking by who had the medical knowledge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
They should. Overhearing them talk.
Yeah.
It might raise some questions.
Absolutely. And then Steele, we've got him in the lab trying to get Corona. The blood tested. he tells the lab tech named Rona that he spilled his blood sample all over Laura's jacket and that he already donated 2 pints to a blood drive earlier that day. And I mean, I looked it up. two pints would in fact be a dangerous amount of blood to lose, but not something that would kill anybody.
Yeah. But they wouldn't allow you to do two pints unless lied to them.
Of course they wouldn't. So that was funny. And then he asked her to run the blood test. And as I mentioned before, the scene with the lab tech in which Steele flirts with her in order to get her to do the test shows us that he's more than aware that he's handsome. He's able to get what he wants from women, but somehow doesn't come across as terribly sleazy while doing it. But the thing is that I wondered, is this woman really that dumb to buy this story, or does she simply not care because she's charmed by him? And ethics?
Yeah. Ethics? Question mark?
Question mark?
I can't. It's hard to say. We don't get a whole lot of information about her. We don't have a lot of interaction from her. So it's hard to say whether she's really that dumb or not. But my first instinct is that she doesn't get. Okay, I'll use the phrase. She doesn't get hit on a lot.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of flattered that she's getting hit on by somebody, especially as, you know, good looking as Remington Steele.
Yeah, fair.
So, yeah, probably not listening that closely to the story, or just, okay, it's just his way of flirting and wow, I mean, I lucky. Wow. And yeah, I'll do what he wants. It's silly. It's kind of dumb. I mean, nobody's going to buy the story, but yeah, I'll do it for him. That's the only thing I can think of, is that she's just flattered by his attention to her and she's willing to overlook.
Yeah, I guess. Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, she asks for his room number in exchange for the jacket being tested. She says she's slated for night duty and that he is an insomniac. Ooh, and it would have been. But here's the thing. It would have been easy enough for Steele to just say he has a roommate. Why didn't he just say that? I mean, technically he does. They're not going to fool around next to Bickerman. So.
No, that would have been the better solution. Although maybe if he said that, or he thought that if he said that, she would not be as willing to run the tests on the blood on the jacket. True. Whereas if you let her have this false hope, she'll follow the breadcrumbs. She'll follow the Reese's pieces until she does what you want her to do. And then you say, okay, well, the bag's empty. Sorry, no more Reese's pieces.
Yeah, Reese's pieces. Reese's Pierces, huh? Huh? Oh. Sorry. I apologize.
There you
go.
Look at that. I see what you did there.
Yeah. I immediately regret it, but there it is. Okay. So yeah, Laura is looking at the polygraph readout of the data. Ivan comes up behind her and asks if the police are there yet. I gotta wonder, why is she looking at the data? She can't read it. This wouldn't really tell her much of anything, given especially how little she knows about medicine, but I don't know, maybe she's looking for patterns or lack of patterns. Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing where, because she's not medically adept, she's not going to recognize the difference between insomnia or narcolepsy.
Yeah.
You know, she won't be able to tell the difference, but yeah, you're right. Maybe she will see something that seems inconsistent. But how likely is it that she would see something that a trained doctor wouldn't see?
Well, that's the thing too, right? It just, you'd think Lindstrom probably saw the readouts at some point, and if he didn't notice it, I don't know.
Yeah.
But she asks him to recount what happened. He says he came down as usual. Nurse Blackall hooked him up to the machine. He says he had a night terror, grabbed someone by the neck and woke up with the jacket in his hand. Mm-hmm. She tries to get more information, but the nurse shows up and basically says she's interfering with monitoring his sleep processes, which is interesting because chain of command wise, without knowing any better, Laura would theoretically be the authority on that. We both know she isn't, but you would think the nurse would defer to her.
Yeah, you know, I had it written down that Nurse Blackwell is only a nurse, but she seems to think she runs the place.
Yeah.
And probably doesn't have a lot of friends.
No, I can't imagine she does. Yeah.
No, she is the quintessential jerk.
Yeah.
But I guess she's like those people that they've always been bullied or whatever. And then you give them a little bit of authority and they just wreak havoc in everybody's lives because they're petty little people with a lot of power. And
you usually find them in positions of power.
Yeah. That they haven't really earned. They've just managed to get their way into. So, she definitely has no business telling a doctor what to do. And if a doctor wants to consult with a patient, that's the doctor's privilege, I would think.
You would think. And yet there she is, kicking her out of the room.
On the other hand, she does have a point that it's a research facility.
True.
And if you're interfering with the research, you are basically invalidating the research.
Yeah.
You're damaging the evidence, which invalidates the research. So she has a point. Yep.
She does. And Laura does, she leaves. And then we switch over to the scene with Wicker, Dr. Wickers, who pulls Steele aside and offers himself as a second opinion because Laura is, quote, hopelessly new. And again, setting aside the fact that Laura is terrible undercover and clearly doesn't portray herself as knowing anything about medicine. If she had, I get the feeling he would have treated her this way regardless. I get the feeling that Terry Wickers is sort of the kind of guy who thinks that she's a pretty little thing, but that, you know, he's the one that knows best. And he sort of admits that Lindstrom is close to losing the funding. He wants to start a chain of private sleep clinics. And here's my question, because this is my Canadian-ness showing through again. Aren't hospitals by definition private? Like, you have to pay to use them, do you not? Or what's the difference between a teaching hospital and a private sleep clinic? Like, what would be the...
Well, I think there are hospitals that are more public facilities in the sense that they're not-for-profit facilities.
Right.
And then you have the ones that are strictly for profit. Well, I don't want to say strictly for profit because theoretically their primary purpose is the treatment of individuals for their medical needs.
Right.
But they are a for-profit facility as opposed to a non-profit.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you've got a bunch of private clinics. Usually they're not large hospitals, I don't think. Usually the large hospitals are more on the nonprofit side, but you have, for example, the emergency walk-in clinics.
Right.
Those, I think, are primarily privately owned and for-profit type organizations.
Interesting.
Now, if it's a teaching hospital that is getting federal money for research, that could be a whole different other animal that gets really ugly, you know, like a duck-billed platypus. So I don't know.
We do not have anything against duck-billed platypuses. Please do not email with angry comments about insults to the duck-billed platypus. That's
my even though they probably deserve it.
Public service announcement. Okay, that's interesting because I don't know, having not lived in the U.S., I've been through the U.S., I've been through 22 U.S. states, but I've obviously never accessed medical facilities in the U.S., and we don't really know much about what gets paid for and what doesn't, or at least I don't. There might be other Canadians that have more knowledge than I do, but here, a hospital is a hospital is a hospital. As long as you have, you know, in Ontario, we have a health card that basically gives us access to whatever walk-in clinics are under that coverage. So there wouldn't be, like, if you have a private clinic pop up here, it would be very rare, and it would be, and it's interesting because he says he wants to branch out eventually and sell mattresses and pillows. So, I just kind of think, like, that just, again, kind of feeds into that whole capitalism. Yeah, like, let's sell as much stuff as we can, and wants to franchise it, right? And he wants Steele to be a part of the franchise, which Steele is interestingly opposed to. When I think it was just a couple episodes ago, he was talking about Remington Steele offices and shopping malls. So
yeah. But see, this is different.
Sure. How?
isn't that the excuse for everything? But this is different.
I mean, it is, but I'm not sure it applies.
No, you know, it's the thing is, I have written down here that Wicker's kind of a sleazy used car salesman.
Oh, he's super
more interested
sleazy.
In money than yeah. his patients. And I think that's the problem here is that Wicker is not interested in making a successful clinic.
No.
And then once it's successful, sees that this could be useful and beneficial in other places. So we're going to expand. That's a motive that, even though there might be capitalism involved in that, obviously there is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is everywhere.
His principle is we're going to help people. We're going to help patients. And we are going to be able to profit by, you know, in the process of doing that. Whereas what he's pushing here is basically, as we talked about earlier, multi-level marketing. We're not selling the product. We're selling the program.
We're selling the pillows and the mattresses and the
which are the program. It's the stuff that goes with the the sleep clinics. The sleep clinic is just an excuse to sell the mattresses and the pillows.
Yep.
But that's not how it's supposed to be.
No. And I mean, my Canadianness would argue that medicine should never be for profit. But then I am not. This is where everybody starts to think that I'm a crazy communist or something like that. I'm not. I just like being able to go to the hospital without worrying about a bill. So.
Well, everything's got to be for profit to some degree, because if nobody was making a profit, you couldn't pay your bills.
Yeah.
But yeah, it comes down to what is your motivating factor.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, we do pay for our medical system. It's just through taxes. It's not at the point of sale sort of thing. Anyway, back to the episode. Laura's fake examination on Bickerman. Oh, I mean, he points out his heart is on the other side, and then she starts making up body parts. Which is
like an auto mechanic, you know, or a sleazy auto mechanic,
or somebody on an episode of Star Trek where they just start throwing out the Trekno babble and we're nodding ahead and following along, pretending we know what they're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then she hands him the water pitcher.
The water pitcher.
Hands him a water pitcher and says, fill it.
I don't know how anyone is buying that she's a doctor, including the patients.
No.
Because I've never been handed a water pitcher, I can tell you that much.
And then when she says fill it to the line, and he says what line, she takes a grease pencil.
She draws it
and puts it at the top. at the top. Oh, what does she expect? Hook this guy up to a beer hat so he can just let it go.
Just run the water a lot, you know? Think about the ocean.
Yes.
Oh, that's probably the best part of the episode, I think, is when she's, here you go. Here's a water. Actually, you know what I thought it was? I didn't think it was a water pitcher because, and here's again another Canadianism that's actually more common on the east coast of Canada as opposed to the west coast. But have you ever heard of milk in bags?
Milk in bags?
Yeah.
Well, I know that I've seen that you can buy milk in boxes, like boxed wine.
Yep.
And so I would presume that there's a bag inside because that's how a boxed wine is. I've seen those mostly in, this is going back for all of you people who are under my age, you will not recognize this. Back in cafeteria services where you would get a glass and you would go up to this contraption and it had this big old handle on it and you pull the handle forward and the little nozzle was actually like an oversized straw coming out of the bag that was inside the dispenser, and the milk would come out that way, and then that's how you got your milk at these institutional type cafeteria places. That's what I think of when you say that.
Okay, so if you ever come to Ontario, this is going to really be weird because this confused the crap out of my husband, who's from Scotland and had to really get used to this. When you go to buy milk in Ontario, you have the option of buying the carton, sure, but most Canadians buy individual bags of milk. And you put the bag in a little pitcher when you get home. Everybody's got a milk pitcher. That's just what we have. You put it in a little pitcher and you cut the corner off of the bag. And then you pour the milk that way. And they come in, you buy three bags at once. They're in another bag. It comes out to just, I think, over 4 liters in total. And that's how we drink our milk. And so my poor husband, when he first came here, couldn't get the bag in properly because you have to really like shake it in order for it to go down all the way. Because if it sticks up a little bit, the whole thing flops over and spills all over the place. And then he would cut the wrong sized hole because cut it too big and it comes out way too fast. Cut it too small and it's, you know, it's a science. So
why do you buy it in bags? If that's the kind of trouble you have to deal with when buying it in bags, why not just buy it in the carton? It's so much simpler.
You get more, and I think it's environmentally friendly. I don't know. I don't have an answer for you, but this is how we do it.
Cartons are cardboard. They're made out of wood products. They are.
Yeah.
Compostable, you know, it's not like plastic milk jugs like we have so commonly down here in the U.S.
Stop poking holes in my. You do get more than you get in the cartons. The cartons only come up to.
I can buy another carton.
Okay, but we're lazy. It's cold outside. But the pitcher that Bickerman has. It reminds me of a milk pitcher. It looks almost identical to a milk pitcher. So that pot, to me, it wasn't a water pitcher. She handed him, it was a milk pitcher. And
either one, it's not used for urine samples. I can guarantee you that.
No, it is not. And the one thing that drives you crazy when it comes to the bags of milk also is who has to change the bag? Because once the bag runs out, you have to get another bag and put it in. And so my husband and I find ourselves playing what I like to call milk bag chicken, where I only ever use the milk for tea, really. I don't drink it as a glass of milk. I don't really like milk, but I put it in my tea. I don't really have cereal. So in order to avoid changing the bag, I will progressively pour like less and less and less in my tea so that he has to be the one to switch it. Mm-hmm. Technically, he doesn't know that that's why I'm doing it. So I guess if he listens to this, he will. But anyway.
I'm familiar with the game. It's played a little bit differently in my experience, but yeah.
Yeah, yours, have to go out. You'd have to be the one to go out and buy a new carton. So there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway.
How do we get onto this?
Bickerman eventually lets it slip that he didn't want to be there, but his company made him do it. And Laura then says he's going to have to undergo more tests. Who's going to be running them? I mean, obviously this is her just saying it, but Bickerman, he comments that she seems to lose a lot of paperwork, which again fits this theory of she's a terrible doctor and doesn't know how to go undercover. Mm-hmm. And that's when she gives him the jug. He goes into the bathroom, and then Steele points out she might want to look into Wicker. And when Laura asks why, he says he doesn't like people who are abusively nice, which I found funny because I didn't find him nice at all. I found him very sleazy, as you said. So yeah, that's kind of a funny way to put it. But he points out that he's waiting for the clinic to collapse and then says that he finds the idea of using Remington Steele's name to hawk pillows just shy of revolting. And again, I ask why. He didn't seem to mind publishing a book. He's talked about franchising the offices. So what is it about pillows that you think he doesn't like?
They're not about him.
That's a good point. Okay. Yeah. True.
I mean, that's other than just the idea that somehow hawking pillows is different than a book about him or his in quotes.
Yeah.
His detective agency. It's just that it's not about him.
Okay. Yeah. I'll buy that for sure. Cause he does seem to be rather singularly focused in a lot of times. Yes. But yeah, so we switch scenes. Laura's asleep. She wakes up. He's there. It's interesting that she doesn't yelp or jump up. She just sort of shakes him awake. And when he says, hey, he mentions the hay is nice during harvest time, which, okay, weird dream to have. But then he tells her, I'm not trying to sleep with you. I'm just trying to sleep with you. Indicating that he is, in fact, exhausted.
Yes.
And then she shows him Ivan's printouts, mentions that she thinks Nurse Blackwell might be responsible. And poor Steele, like, she's basically making him leave. She says Bickerman would miss him. She makes him go back to his bed. I'd say goodnight, but honesty prevents me, is what he says. Why not let him just get an hour or two? Sleep deprivation is no joke. I can't imagine he would be particularly effective if he's, and he isn't later on, as we see when he tries to pick the lock. Like,
yeah, it. The only thing I can think of is that somebody might miss him and start raising questions. But yeah, I mean, for an hour.
But then she could just say that she was running tests, right? Like, she could cover that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just, okay, I was doing an interview with him. Of course, that might be.
I asked him to fill a pitcher.
Consider it a euphemism for something else. But okay. Okay. Let's control ourselves. But, you know, yeah, she could cover it somehow just to get him an hour's of sleep.
Poor guy.
I don't know. It does seem a little bit unfair of her.
Yeah. I mean, he leaves. Laura's in the office. The door's propped open. She thinks he's come back. She checks. He's not there. She goes in the hallway and sees the light turn off. She goes in the room. Nobody's there. And this is the point where the music really starts to ramp up. And it's really anxiety inducing. The score I noticed in this episode is really, really good. It's very horror movie-esque. It's just almost beautiful. Like, she can't get back to her office. She heads back down the hall to the elevator. We see the shot of someone following her, slippers over their shoes. She gets to the elevator. The person goes into the stairwell. She gets out and then hides behind the door, grabbing that empty IV bottle. And then the shot of the lurching body gets closer and closer until eventually the fingers curl around the door frame. This is genius. Whoever, I guess we know, Seymour Robbie directed this. It's probably one of the most intensely suspenseful moments of the show. And I wondered if you sort of kind of got that same, like, whoa moment watching that particular scene.
Yeah, I mean, it was very well done. And with all due respect to Seymour Robbie, let's also credit the editors.
Yeah,
because editing can make or break something like this. And so whoever did the editing on this did a very good job of taking what Seymour Robbie gave them and blending it into this. And then, of course, then there's the music. But yeah, I mean, it was very well done, very suspenseful, very reminiscent of what I would expect to be the type of thing you would see in a horror movie, which, again, as I've mentioned in the past, is not really my genre. But yeah, it's very tense.
It's definitely my genre. But, and I can say that this is like pitch perfect suspense. Like they really knew what they were doing.
But isn't there something in the detective's handbook? Yeah. About not wandering around alone through some deserted rooms in a hospital when somebody is out to kill people.
And they know it. I mean, right? They found it. It's not like she's just missing. They found the body. She's dead. Someone killed her.
Yes.
Yeah. But
don't you people watch any movies?
Yeah, they didn't see the movie in this case. I guess Steele's not really into horror, but before the attack actually takes place, that lab tech calls her name. The figures disappear and the tech asks her what she's doing. Laura asks if the bottle she's holding is plasma.
Oh, it's empty.
It's empty. Like, come on. She's the worst. And then she asks if she's got the results of Steele's blood test. And the tech hints that she wants to bring the results up personally. Laura is rightfully, yes. She behaves rightfully shocked and says, you're not entertaining the thought of responding in kind. And then the lab tech says, I didn't think it would hurt anything. And then makes a comment about like how they never get a crack at any of the good ones. What? Like the
like we talked about earlier, just sexual escapades all over the place.
Well, not just that, but like this is a patient. That would cross all sorts. Well,
obviously, that doesn't matter.
I mean, it should.
Well,
My dentist, okay, here's a story. My dentist got his license suspended for 6 months. This is a dentist who had been my dentist since I was since I grew teeth like a baby. And he got his license suspended for 6 months for marrying one of his patients. So it's taken very seriously. Like, you're not supposed to be involved in any way with a patient. It breaks all sorts of ethical boundaries. And this lab tech is hinting that, like, the doctors are doing it all the time. So,
yeah. Hey, so why can't we have our shot
like,
at it?
Why don't we get one? Like, this is the worst hospital. Yeah. Forget Lockter. This is why they don't notice that Laura's a terrible doctor. This is a bad hospital.
They're too busy making rendezvous for sexual liaisons.
Yeah, this is Melrose Place in a hospital is what this is. So, yeah, she's taken the results back. And I'd have to think as well that this would sound very differently if the tech were a man and the patient was a woman. Like, it would read
different. Yeah.
So then we switch the scene. Steele is with Ivan. Steele describes to Ivan what happened to Dr. Marcus. Ivan passes out just as Laura comes up and tells Steele that Ivan didn't do it because she was followed at the same time. So he couldn't have been the one. And she points out that the blood doesn't match either Ivan or Dr. Marcus.
Also, how realistic would it be to think that a guy who can't stay awake, falls asleep at the slightest moment of stress, could manage to hurt anyone?
Yeah.
In his sleep. Yes, we know he would do that in his sleep. And we know that he thought he did it in his sleep. Yeah. But so far, he hasn't actually hurt anybody in his sleep. He was dragging cars into the fountains and that sort of thing. But doesn't seem likely.
Yeah.
All the other evidence just to me confirms that he can't be.
Yeah. And then Laura decides it's time to fill in Lindstrom. Why now? If her logic before was that they needed a culprit in order to prevent the clinic from being shut down, what makes a difference now? They're no more ahead than they were before. They just know that Ivan didn't do it.
The only other thing that has changed is that she has been stalked.
True.
And so it's not just that Dr. Marcus was a murder victim and she was probably the target. It's now, okay, Dr. Marcus was the murder victim and she was a target of possibly many other targets.
That's true, because now it's potentially a serial killer.
Yeah. So that's the only thing that's really changed, other than, as you said, they've eliminated Ivan.
Yeah. And then Steele and Ivan, they sneak into the locker room. He tells Ivan that he intends to prove he's innocent. Ivan tells Steele about the various ways that narcolepsy has basically ruined his life. And Steele breaks into Wicker's locker, which Ivan says asks how he managed that. Steele replies with a certain God-given talent and a lot of practice, which we find out fails him later. And then he finds the photo of Dr. Marcus and Dr. Wickers together in his locker. Since we know he's innocent, why isn't he worried about Sheila Marcus disappearing, like Wicker? Even if it was casual, you'd think he would be a bit concerned. Or sorry, Lindstrom, I meant. Like, not Wicker. Yeah. I meant to say Lindstrom, since we know Lindstrom is innocent.
Okay. I was trying to track that question.
Why isn't he worried about Sheila Marcus disappearing? Like you'd think if you were seeing somebody and she disappears, you'd be... Maybe that's why he didn't want the police to know before.
That would be a reason. I don't know that that's necessarily strong enough of a reason. The only thing I can think of is that it was not important enough to him.
Yeah, that's true.
That's probably not a nice thing to say, but okay, so she disappeared. Yeah, okay, she was a fling.
Yeah.
It's going to be inconvenient replacing her as a doctor if something happened to her, but that combined with the fact that maybe he didn't want the police to find out about his relationship.
He does mention that she was seeing other men and that he knew that. And then he says that she loved all men, but not in a way that was dirty or cheap, which I, again, find interesting.
She was just philanthropic.
Yeah, philanthropic. I think that's a word that gets used, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But I find it interesting that he didn't really seem to mind. But I guess maybe, again, like you said, that's because it was a casual fling and it wasn't really serious. So this has got to be the horniest hospital ever, though, is pardon my language, but like everybody's involved with everybody else. So
yeah, just take a number. You're next.
Exactly. And then Laura points out that if the stethoscope belonged to Wicker, that he's likely the culprit. Lindstrom doesn't believe her and needs to hear it from Steele, who's fallen asleep in the chair and uses the most dad excuse ever. I was meditating, which is basically the same as I was resting my eyes. Same thing. So, yeah. And then he asks when they leave what he just agreed to. And Laura tells him that the stethoscope might be the murder weapon. He's astounded at the idea that he came up with that one. But before they can get any further, Nurse Blackall tells him it's time for him to be hooked up to the machine, which he's obviously not very comfortable with. But Blackall doesn't make him feel any better once she's hooked him up. She's, again, her bedside manner leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, that presumes she has a bedside manner.
Yeah.
She doesn't.
And then we skip ahead a little bit. Steele obviously slept a little bit because he wakes up and he looks into her station. She's not there. This is where he sort of accidentally solves the case, in, or at least part of it, because he gets out, he puts pillows and blankets under the, or pillows under the blanket, sorry, which I have to say fits in with our theory that this is the worst hospital ever, because I don't think anybody, given how he arranges it, would believe a body was underneath, but whatever. So he leaves and goes over to the readout station where he switches his results with the guy next to him. And wouldn't that mess with the other guy's results? I realize the murderer did it because that's the murderer, but Steele has to know that he's screwing stuff up here.
Well, and that was kind of what I was alluding to earlier, is that at some point when Bickerman had done it,
yeah,
we find out it was Bickerman, when he had done it at the beginning and murdered Dr. Marcus, somebody was going to look at those readouts and somebody was going to notice it. And yeah, it's absolutely, because as Ivan says later on, the difference between a narcoleptic and an insomniac are different. They're like fingerprints.
Yep.
They're totally different. And yeah, exactly what you said.
I would think it would be obvious. Yeah.
Yes.
So Laura goes into Wicker's office. She sees him in the chair, but before he responds, she's attacked from behind. She manages to stab, which we assume is Bickerman, with a needle. We can see Steele running towards the room where he finds Laura. She tells him she's been stabbed with something, that she stabbed him with something, meaning her attacker. But that's when Steele turns on the lights, sees Wicker stabbed to death with scissors, and assumes that Laura killed Wicker. She insists she didn't, and the stethoscope was a plant. I would think Wicker's body would get noticed at this point, but it doesn't.
Well, and also, it's pretty insulting to say that you cannot, even in the dark, tell the difference between the feel of a pair of scissors and a hypodermic syringe. I mean, they have a completely different feel. It doesn't matter whether it's a lit room or a dark room. You can tell the difference. And to say, well, he was stabbed with scissors, so you must have stabbed him with that. It's like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of insulting to kind of like argue with her on that, because you're right. She would know the feel of a needle versus scissors. And then, of course, she sees the wires in his pockets. He admits he switched the connection with the other patient. She realizes what has happened and gets Ivan to follow. And then Ivan says, you know, for a doctor, she seems pretty good at this, which is good because she's a terrible doctor.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing that her talents lie elsewhere.
Yes.
So then Laura talks to Nurse Blackall. Steele uses that distraction to pick the lock to the records room with Ivan for cover. And this is, in my opinion, the funniest scene in the episode, because he's so tired that he's struggling to pick the lock and can't do it because he's exhausted. So, of course, it subtly plays like a performance metaphor and makes it doubly hilarious, especially after it took him 5 minutes. And he says, if the union ever caught wind of this.
You belong to a union? Yeah, I love that whole bit there.
Yep.
You know, I should be able to do this in my sleep. I forget I said that.
And then 5 minutes, you're slipping, you know. It's good. It's really good. And then
he is very good at comedy.
Yeah.
He really is.
Yeah.
And it's a shame he doesn't do more of it.
I know. Anytime he's done a movie where he's playing a comedic character, he's doing a comedic performance, I watch that, because he is just really funny. And then Laura asks, we switch back over to Blackall. She questions her about how often she leaves her station when she monitors the patients. She says she tries to check in on the patient, on other patients if she can. Given that she's supposed to be monitoring Steele right now, is this one of her brief moments? Because it's actually been quite a while. that she's been gone.
Yeah. You know, I would question the entire operation of this hospital. Really? Because if you're supposed to be... I know. I'm slow on the uptake, aren't I?
Are you trying to say this is not a great hospital?
Okay. I mean, if you're supposed to be monitoring the equipment on the patients, would you really be tasked with going about and checking other patients?
No, you wouldn't.
Your job is to stay there and watch them. Make sure that they don't get up and wander around or whatever. You keep them herded into that space. That's your job. For 8 hours, that's your job.
Yeah, you'd get some bathroom breaks, but that would be about it.
But somebody would be covering for you.
Yeah, true.
You're not going to be leaving those patients unattended. I wouldn't think. No. I'm not an expert. You know, I'm probably a better doctor than Laura is, but I don't think that would be acceptable procedure.
I'm not a doctor. I just play one on TV. And this is where they get their hands on the readouts. Laura comes in and they notice the half hour where the readout switches from insomnia to narcoleptic. Okay, Laura is suddenly able to tell the difference between a narcoleptic and an insomniac. Sure. But Ivan does point out that she's right. So at least that kind of helps. And then they go hiding to wait for the killer. Steele hopes he shows up sooner. He's going to fall asleep and miss what's going on. And then she promises him that if they catch the killer, that he can spend the next day in bed. Steele says it sounds especially nice when she says it with that soft lilt, which is another kind of indicator of how comfortable they've become with one another. When he mentions the lilt in her voice, she seems genuinely touched and sort of flattered that he's noticed these details. Kind of like she was when he noticed the scowl, the crinkle and scowl bit. And he tells her that chasing her has become a noble pursuit and that she admits that she would hate for him to give it up and that she's never had a man cook for her before, which she lived with Wilson. Damn, mm-hmm. Wilson. What are you doing, man? Not once?
Hey, Tim Hortons.
Yeah. Ouch, man, that sucks. Like, so I guess no.
If man had been intended to cook, they wouldn't have invented Tim Hortons.
Yeah, fair. But that's here in Canada. You guys don't have those. Well, I guess there's some in the U.S.
Let's see. There's an equivalent to Tim Hortons down here, and I don't remember what it is.
But yeah, so they almost kiss, and then he falls asleep. She tips his head to face him when the killer comes in the room. And they turn on the lights to find out it's Bickerman, which we find out in the course of this scene that he had a morphine addiction due to an injury that caused him to become addicted to morphine and that he killed Dr. Marcus to prevent his blood sample from revealing it. He pulls a gun. Where was he hiding that? Those hospital gowns don't have pockets.
Don't ask. You know, it's like those... some other TV shows, detective TV shows, where you've got particularly female detectives wearing tight-fitting clothes that hide nothing. And I'm thinking of White Collar in the first season, where one of the female detectives is wearing this really, really tight, slinky dress. And Caffrey's comment is, so where do you hide your gun? Because there is no place to hide your gun there.
Well,
except places we don't want.
Did you ever watch Highlander, the series?
No.
There was this theory with fans of the show, because in the show, they're always pulling out swords to cut people's heads off. And some of them wear long trench coats, but not always, right? So sometimes they pull out a sword and we're like, wait a minute, where did that come from? And so there's this sort of fan theory that their coats all have like an interdimensional pocket where they hide their sword. So could be that. Just saying. You never know. She might be immortal. Just pointing out some options. Or like that episode of Doctor Who where Captain Jack is on that extreme makeover show and he's naked and he pulls out a gun. And the robot lady asks, where were you hiding that? And he says, you don't want to know. I think it's best that we just
know. Yeah, I think that's usually what most people think is you don't want to know.
So, okay, I withdraw the question.
Anyway. Now that we've thoroughly explored the question, we're going to withdraw. Yeah. Yes.
Bickerman, he basically does the whole thing where the villain monologues and says that he got injured, mm-hmm. became reliant on morphine, says it ruined his life, his marriage, which is interesting because Ivan had the same experience, but obviously didn't become a killer. Laura knocks over some boxes. Steele jumps on Bickerman. which is a really interesting move, is it kind of requires a high level of trust between the two of them. Like, she had to assume that he would make that move after she knocked over the boxes. So again, no more evidence they're kind of a little bit closer than they were. Bickerman escapes. Steele tells Ivan to tackle him, and he does, determined not to fall asleep. So yes. Good for Ivan.
Yes.
And they catch the killer. So yeah, it was a cute little, he's so proud of himself at the end, Ivan. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, hey, that's an accomplishment.
It is.
That's a major accomplishment for him, I would imagine.
Yeah. And exonerates him too, right? So it would be.
Well, there's that too. Yeah. But they had kind of already done that. So this is just kind of the icing on the cake, where he's actually proven that he can stay awake in a time of crisis and not fall asleep and actually be somewhat productive in some sense.
Yeah. I mean, he helps them the whole way.
So yeah, major, major thing for him.
So go Ivan. And then we've got a little scene switch. They're having dinner at Steele's apartment with Ivan and Lindstrom. And they go into the kitchen to get dessert after having their client over for dinner. And poor Steele admits that he can't sleep now, which gives us further insight to his character. Although I wonder, if he's so exhausted, how did he manage to make that meal?
He ordered it out. He just put it in the microwave and heated
it. Maybe he froze the duck, the Canardo Van Rouge, and he's just thawed it out.
Could be that. Could be.
But yeah, he admits he's becoming an insomniac, and Laura offers to have Dr. Holt take a look at the patient. All I can think of is, dear God, no. Dr. Holt.
World's worst thought.
He'd probably end up with something amputated. It would just not be good.
Maybe he's just hoping she'll play doctor.
Well, she's not good at that. We just saw a whole episode.
Well, hey, if you do it right, you don't have to be good at it.
Which is, I mean, and to be fair, she's never quite been this boldly flirtatious before, right? This is her.
That's true.
Being very explicit. And then he explains that he's become an insomniac, and he says the quote, "Be careful of what you pretend to be, because you are what you pretend to be," which is referring to the fact that he was pretending to be.
Except that's not the quote.
An insomniac. Well, I mean, maybe.
I looked it up.
It's not a quote.
Well, it is a quote, but it's a wrong quote. Okay, it's so an incorrect quote. It's a misquote.
Misquoting it.
Yeah, the notion is correct.
Right.
And he was correct when he said Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, I didn't look it up.
Well, the actual quote is, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be."
Okay.
Kurt Vonnegut Jr.
Yes. You have to wonder why they didn't just write that, because it's not that different. But either way.
Maybe it was a copyright issue.
Could have been, yeah. That's a good point. He's referring to the fact that he was pretending to be an insomniac, which led him to be unable to sleep for real. But it also very much describes the journey that his character has taken so far. Because at the beginning, he was merely pretending to be Remington Steele, and now he's started to embody some of the characteristics, not all, obviously, but some of the characteristics that Laura envisioned, albeit with his own twist. And what's more, she's starting to see him as more than a con man as well. Like, she's starting to see the man he is becoming. Did you get in that impression as well with that line, or just in general?
I didn't think of it in that way, but no, you're right. It can be read that way. Absolutely. Yeah. I was more interested in the fact that they had their first official kiss here.
And I was just going to mention that they've had their first real kiss in the we've got plausible deniability with Steele, Waters Run Deep. This, and that she initiates it. He's half asleep. He's literally asleep. Like, consent issues aside here, like, she goes for it, you know?
I don't think he's going to complain.
No, he doesn't. He wakes up and he's like, hey.
Play doctor anytime.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, and she starts like by giving him this massage to his temples. And then he wakes up very quickly, responds very enthusiastically. And it kind of goes to show that she's beginning to see him as a real possibility instead of just an annoyance or itchy. So, yeah, I think it was an interesting way to end the episode.
Which is the end of the episode.
Brings us to the end. Any other thoughts on the episode in general, or?
No, I mean, there was a lot of good stuff in this one.
Yeah.
And you're right. Paul Reiser, you know, they had some great guest stars on this show.
They really did.
And some of them were established people
that
did a great job. And then there were others like Paul Reiser who were not established in any sense yet, but they just did a fantastic job. And his portrayal of this character, who just, he's so afraid he did something wrong, and he just can't have, it's a great portrayal.
Yeah.
It's very well done.
Yeah. He's very sympathetic. Like, we feel he's kind of like, what's his face? The FBI, Sheldon, in the sense that you really kind of feel bad when he talks about all the stuff he's gone through. You really feel bad for him. Cause like, that would really suck to have that ruin your life, basically. So
yeah, very well done. Anyway, so you want to close this?
Yeah. So we've got our website, www.steelwatching.com, show notes, links to Amazon, where movies that are mentioned, I think Coma and, The Big Sleep. That was the other one. Yep. And maybe you could talk about our social media resources.
Yeah. Before I do, we'll mention that on Amazon links, the Amazon Associates program, as we've kind of mentioned in the past, is very, very much about what have you done for us today? And apparently we haven't done enough for Amazon today because we have been dropped from their Associates program. So we're not going to make any money off of anything that you purchase through our links, but we're still going to be providing the links to the movies because we want to make it easy for you to find these and to get them. So rather than having to do a search on Amazon or something like that, if you're on our website, if you're in the show notes on your podcast player, just click on it. It'll take you to it. And there you go. So having said that, yes, we have on the website links that you can use to follow the podcast in your favorite pod player, links to the official Steel Watching Facebook page, links to the Steel Watchers Facebook group, links to our Twitter and Instagram pages. So all that stuff, anything you want to know about this episode that we've talked about, it's all right there in our show notes on our website. So our next episode will be
Hearts of Steel, which is yours.
Yes, that's mine. Mm-hmm. So join us for that next time. And in the meantime, this was fun.
Yeah.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Hey, everybody. Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating? Oh,
yeah. Yes, it does. Every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.